on, jump.
I don't know if I'll make it.
Hurry, the floor is lava.
Oops. Hey, life happens, which is why your favorite styles from Ashley are available in life-resistant, high-performance fabric with removable, machine-washable fabric slipcovers that make it easy to clean spills, dirt, and imaginary lava. For more mess and less stress, shop Ashley's high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
And we're back with an all new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel. We're recording this on the longest day of the year, if I'm not mistaken, which I feel like I always need to commemorate in some way, like go out and hang out outside and enjoy the moment. Did I mention that I find summer stressful? Like I need to enjoy it immediately or I'm failing anyway.
Girl, you don't like fall. Okay. Summer stresses you out.
Right.
Which season is for you?
Summer is for me, though it's just a handful.
Okay. All right. My season is the one of love.
Okay. Oh, that would be 67, Summer of Love. Yes.
Well, I'm talking about my 525,600 minutes.
Oh, I see. Wait, that's a year, but all right.
a year in the life is an entire season of love, okay?
Oh, that's right. Yes. Which Rent character are you mostly, would you say?
That's an interesting question. You know, whatever gays are around asking, who are you? No one ever asks, like, which Rent character are you? You know?
Right. And they are disparate entities. I mean, like, that's sort of the strength of the musical is that you do get really distinct characters on it. Mm-hmm. I do feel that Mimi is the most annoying. So I feel like as somebody who spouts hot takes for a living, I would have to say Mimi, but.
You know, I am constantly looking for a bag on the floor.
Yeah, right.
Speaking in third person, they call me Mimi. I don't know. I'd probably end up being like Mark or so. No, I wouldn't be Mark. You know what? I think I'm more Roger. Probably like an angry artist. I would yell at people to get out of my home.
Okay. And you find that to be his signature thing. Okay, great.
He's always like, get out. Who are you?
What a movie that nobody has watched in 17 years. I remember that came out in college. We were all obsessed with the idea of it. And then I sort of lump it in my brain with, what else was coming out that time? Like The Notebook is what we remember from that time, or Mean Girls, not that movie. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Who would you be?
I mean, I guess I would have to say Mimi. Were you not paying attention a second ago?
Oh yeah. Oh, I thought you were dragging me.
Oh, that too. No, I think we're both Mimis, and I think it's unfortunate.
You think we're both Mimis. You know what? I
certainly dressed like Mark once upon a time. I mean, I remember the age of H&M. You know what I'm saying?
Baby, I saw you going into the gay bar the other day. And I had a wistful look. I was like, Louis dresses so well now.
Oh, that's true. I mean, like, I definitely dress less like I made the t-shirt myself on an app.
Less like it's your first day at Hogwarts.
I've had a few eras. When I moved to LA, I forgot this. It was in January, to be fair, but it was Los Angeles, so it was still not acceptable. I wore a scarf wherever I went. If you've ever been in Los Angeles, it is basically impossible to wear a scarf. You are hot almost immediately. Even if it's like in the colder part of the evening, it's rarely cold enough that you would ever wear a scarf. I also weighed 30 pounds. So it was just a matter of keeping my bones together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like the girl with the red string around her neck, that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm going to land on Mark, you know, struggling filmmaker and, you know, commiserating with someone else about the person who dumped us.
That is you. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. That's me.
You also looked a little like Tintin, which I am instinctively into.
I also have not congratulated you on making the logo 30.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this logo does a little commemorative thing every year where they put a bunch of queer people in a list and say, hey, look at these queer people out there being queer. And I ended up being one of them, which I assume means they went through the entire cast of Fire Island already. So in past years. Actually, Conrad Riccamora is on this year's list. So I'm ranked with him. And I have to say, that feels good because I have an insane crush on him at the moment.
Our friend Terrence is on the list.
Who goes by Social B on social media, which is like he runs parties in New York.
Yeah. No, this means that like it's a you're here moment.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just want to say that I've been here for a fucking long time. So to only be here now, it's like Shelby Lynn winning the Best New Artist Grammy when she's like grizzled in her 70s or whatever she got. She's like, Jesus, what have I been doing all these years?
We've just discovered who Louis Vertel is.
Did you know he likes the Oscars? I guess he's been on some game shows. That's all you need to know about me, actually.
That's still how I describe you sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, the one on Jeopardy who did the snap. And they're like, oh, yeah, I love him.
Mm-hmm. It does really communicate my entire entity. I told you one time I was working at the Emmys with Kimmel doing a backstage bit with Guillermo, and this is a few years ago now. And I walked out, and RuPaul comes up to me, puts his hand on his shoulder, kisses my cheek, and goes, "I know you. I use that Jeopardy gif all the time. Slay, mama. How about that?"
I'm shocked that RuPaul knows how to use a gif.
Yeah, I want to know the context. Who's he sending it to?
I imagine RuPaul has green bubbles. I'm sorry. Ru is typing on an Android phone.
Also, well, that segues nicely into our topic today because the song Texts Go Green is a highlight off Drake's new album.
Yeah, we are actually getting into all of our specific areas today. Drake, yeah. Beyonce.
Yes.
Jeopardy for you.
Right. We'll get to that.
Yeah. And Wendy Williams.
That's basically, yeah, Mount Rushmore. You ever heard of it?
Yeah. And of course, Joel Kim Booster is here from Fire Island.
Which is, it's a thrill to talk to him just anyway, because he's our friend. We've known him for 100 years. I used to write with him on Billy on the Street. That's where I met Joel Kim Booster. But obviously, Fire Island is the new movie and adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that takes place on the gay vacation isle. And we talked to him about enlisting a couple of his friends to be in the movie, Bowen Yang, who's been here before, Matt Rogers, who's been here before, and get into the specifics of what makes Fire Island so magical. And I'm thrilled to hear it because I will be there in a week and a half.
So will I.
Will you? Are you there for 4th?
Yeah.
Oh, let me just say this about Ira. I will just be out in the world. I'm telling you, I could go anywhere. I could fly to Burkina Faso. You get off the plane, and the person greeting you says, "Oh, that's so weird. Ira was just here." Like it's constantly cat and mouse, Casino Royale, Carmen Sandiego shit.
We are one of those spy movies. We're just we record a podcast together, but we're also hunting each other down, and one of us will win.
Mr. and Mr. Smith, yes.
All right, we'll be right back with more Keep It. Check out our brand new line of Pride merch now at the Crooked Store. And as always, a portion of every order from our Pride collection is going to the Crooked Pride or Else Fund, which supports 3 incredible organizations that provide community building, gender affirming, and life-saving resources to the queer and transgender community. Shop all Crooked merch at crooked.com/store. I'm going to say that one thing about being in the Beehive is actually a bit like a spy versus spy, Mr. and Mr. Smith, as we were just talking about, because she takes so long between her releases now, yeah, that you're almost sort of dormant as a Beehive member. Like you've experienced me during Beyonce releases, but that goes away after a bit.
Right. No, I mean, because it could feasibly never happen again, too, right? Like, you never are even aware of where Beyonce's head is at during the dormancy period. She's not active on any social media, doesn't give interviews. In fact, her interview game is still unmatched in terms of her elusiveness. She feels lightly like witness protected at all times. And But that's what makes a release of hers particularly exciting, is that she's so intentional with what she does and what she releases, that once you hear you're getting music, you're like, what the hell has she been thinking about for the past 5 years? I guess we're about to find out.
She is a bit of the Zodiac killer when it comes to interviews.
Right. Though the actual Zodiac killer is, of course, Taylor Swift. That's right.
But she recently confirmed that her long-awaited seventh album, Renaissance, will drop on July 29th, a day after my birthday. So I'm just deciding it's my birthday gift. And right. For the first time in forever, she's doing an album rollout. She did like a Vogue cover, British Vogue, and she dropped a single.
When we have to be thankful for these things that every musical artist does except her. So
her single Break My Soul, which she dropped, by the way, on Tuesday instead of Friday, which, if you recall, I believe she was the one who started getting people to release their music on Friday when she dropped her album.
Yes, right. I remember that exactly. For the self-titled album. Correct.
Like, it became New Music Friday. And, you know, if we want to be the old people on the podcast for a minute, music used to come out on Tuesdays. Like, you would go to the record store on a Tuesday.
No, me begging my mom to take me to Best Buy to buy Under Rug Swept by Alanis Morissette in about February 2002 and pick me up from play practice. I've actually just admitted way too much about myself. I'm going to go ahead and slow down.
Obviously, I'm obsessed with the song, but what do you
get
think?
Get this. I thought, I went in nervous because I had heard, okay, it's going to be a dance record, which I was excited about. And then a couple of my friends heard it before I did. And two of them were like, it's terrible. Don't even listen to it. And I said, okay, well, I'll get to it when there's time, I guess. And I like took my time. I went and got food, came back. I fucking love it. The Robin S. single is great.
Yes.
It's so appropriate for fucking Pride Month. It's I like her dabbling in the like early 90s house, sweaty, you know, groove is in the heart is on the radio all the time kind of vibe. That Crystal Waters vibe feels very appropriate for her. I love the danceability of it just in general. I'm surprised people don't like it. Do they not like to dance? I'm confused.
Yeah, I'm surprised too. I'm like, I think the girls need to put down the Xanax. The girls need to turn off Lana
Please.
Del Rey. Like, we have been enduring just like years of like sleepy, depressed music, pop music.
Right.
And I'm glad that she was like, you know what, we're going to dance again. And two, like, I love that she took her time with the 90s revival.
Yeah, because there have been some versions of it. You know, we've gotten the Dua Lipa album. We've gotten the Lady Gaga album. And let me just say, if there's one thing I'm excited about regarding the Beyonce album, it's that we can put away future nostalgia for 10 fucking minutes. I'm sorry, we are on our third summer of this damn album. It's not that I don't like it. I always like hearing Levitating, which is like up by the twist in terms of biggest songs of all time, apparently. Look at the all-time list of number of Billboard hits. They keep a running list of just the biggest songs ever, which is very baffling. But first of all, The Weeknd is now number one with Blinding Lights. Two is The Twist. And Levitating is like 31, and that seemed crazy to me until I realized I never have stopped hearing Levitating.
I love that you said Blinding Lights by accident. because
why didn't I get that call? Like, we're making a video, sweetie.
Because to a certain set of white people who listen to pop music, they would tell you that like house and disco is like basically what future nostalgia and like The Weeknd is. And I love that this little nostalgic moment with Drake too, we'll get into that. It's just, this is actual house music. It's black people reclaiming house music. And like, I love that there's people on Twitter like actually sort of discovering that it is a black genre, like coming, you know, from like black and queer DJs in like Detroit, Chicago, you know. And it's
you would be a fool to think white people came up with that. I'm sorry, are people lost? You know who probably came up with that? Someone who looks like Sherry Lewis. No.
You got me like, Gabrielle, you're going to bring it on? I know you don't think a white girl came up with that.
Yes.
But I think that like they are so fiercely protective of their music legacies in like Detroit and Chicago. And then it's a bit more loose in the rest of the U.S.
Mm.
You know, New York as well. But, you know, New York is like, there's room for everyone sometimes when it comes to nightlife. But
there's so much amazing dance music in the genre of this song that she's evoking on purpose. And I hope people investigate some of it. I'm always bringing up Hey Mr. DJ by Jeanne, which is my favorite kind of cookout ready dance song. But there's a ton of other songs like this. Do you know who Eighth Wonder is?
Yes.
Which is Patsy Kensit, who used to date one of the Gallagher brothers from Oasis. I think she became a British like Big Brother celebrity at some point. Anyway, she has a song called I'm Not Scared that always gets me amped for the summer. It's like moody and sexy.
There's
and
great-
of course, Robin S. herself is, I mean, that song is eternal. It's like, you know, Finally by CeCe Peniston or Groove is in the Heart or any of those songs.
I mean, it is so rude of her to do this to Charlie XCX.
Right. Which it didn't dawn on me until like my eighth listen.
I also wonder, do you think, one, we all know that I'm a Charlie XCX stan. Do we think that what Beyonce had heard Charlie XCX's Used to Know Me with samples Robin S. as well? And do you think that Beyonce knows who Charlie XCX is?
I'm going with no and also no. I think, well, it's hard. No, it's not. I'm going to go with no. By the way, thinking about what Beyonce knows about is just a fun philosophical game in general. I already brought up Billy on the Street before. One of the things I'm proudest about is a line I wrote for Billy to scream at strangers is, do you think Beyonce has ever said the words unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt out loud? Did she tune in? Was she into the antics of Carole Kane? I'm going to say no.
I think she's maybe watched some of it, but as it is with some black people when they watch a show, you don't use the title. Like, sometimes you use an actor's name or you use part of it. I think she's probably said to Jay, like, you ever watch that Kimmy girl? Or you want to watch some of that Kimmy?
Right. Do you, like, she might know Titus Burgess by name, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, so that's sort of the end? Yeah.
She's definitely... Well, so here's the thing. Like, so Beyonce, you know, is working with The Dream again. She's going to be working with Rafael Sadiq. She's allegedly like working with Honey Dijon on this album. Mm. Like, I think she knows producers. She might know Charlie's name only because I'm sure she's heard Fancy and was like,
right,
who made that?
Right. Oh, I remember when Fancy had the world in its grip. I remember desperately wanting it to be remixed with the Reba McEntire Fancy, and then because the internet was the way it was, it occurred.
Yeah. She's had a chokehold. She did have a chokehold on the music industry for quite some time for someone who is still sort of bubbling under.
Yes, right. Well, Charlie XCX also has that kind of Ava Max, Jessie J problem where there's recognizability and talent, but it's not really about, I know what you look like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wear a pop outfit and you always have a pop haircut, but then otherwise, question mark for a face.
Yeah, sometimes you have to go really overboard. Like, honestly, Gaga knew what, like, was a historian of pop music, you know? She knew what a pop star looked like. She knew what she was going to make us, you know, like, remember about her. And she did it every fucking day. Until right. It was like emblazoned in your head, like, okay, Alexander McQueen heels, meat dress, you know, like shit like that.
And even when she emerged, when she had the hard white yellow bangs and the crystalline looking leotards, it was almost like she was doing a play on a pop star. Like it wasn't, I don't want to say it was mocking the idea of a pop star, but it was so bawdy and so, like a hyper-energized version of something you like a Madonna or whoever preceded her, that it became memorable and also cheeky. And then, of course, she added the things like the meat dress and all
well,
the
I mean,
other
paparazzi
that came later.
Itself, you know, the VMA is like her first like live performance was really just sort of like a commentary on like what the music industry did to pop stars.
Right. Right. No, exactly. Like she emerged as somebody who understood everything about pop. Whereas now it feels like the way pop stars generally dress, and I am not including Beyonce in this, it feels like they're just actually doing the performance you see in Vox Lux. which they're wearing that kind of spangled outfit. They're doing those kinds of half moves. There's half hooks in the music. You know, it all kind of ends up blending together, and they don't stand for anything other than a pre-existing idea of a pop star.
And the fashion is boring. Like, the fashion that they wear in their everyday life when they're caught or when they're on the red carpet is boring. The only fashion girl, like, it makes, it's like, it's baffling to me that, like, the only girl that we are constantly talking about on the red carpet is Zendaya.
Right. No, also, I think a big problem is we don't know how to nurture great personalities anymore. It's all about having your team that knows the moves of pop, and you're just repeating those moves that, you know, repeating those footprints that have been stepped in time and time again.
And
maybe I'm just
likeable.
A million years old. Yeah. Yeah. Likeability. Right. The worst word. The lady trap. Likeability.
But anyway, I do like this. There are some people who aren't liking it, but, you know, I'm excited for this album. I'm excited for the summer it's going to bring.
I also think it's a nice about face after, I guess the last thing she gave us is Black is King, which I kind of thought she was moving in a more proverb-oriented direction, shall we say? And for her to just say, like, all right, let's actually just move around for a little bit. You know, let's jump into the splits on a pride float in 1991 for a little while.
Well, you know, when a recession hits, you know, the music usually gets nasty and the dance floor gets crowded.
Wow. Now you're like a historian. I love this CNBC take on gay music.
Well, as you know, when the recession hits, the dance floors tend to get crowded and the music nasty. As Janet Jackson proved when she released Throb. Anyway.
Now, it seems like you're excited about this Drake album, which I did listen to. And I have to tell you, he has a habit of kicking this party into first gear. I would love it to get out of the Xanaxery. Not the dancery. We're in the Xanaxery.
You don't love the album.
I'm not somebody who is in a club with his head hanging low, which I believe is Drake's whole thing.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I would say that the version of house that he's giving us on the album is a bit more ketamine bops. And Beyonce said, if the 90s are back, cocaine is back.
Right. So she's a better historian than he is what you're saying.
Well, she just wants us to dance. And Drake, you know, Drake is still trying to fuck you on the dance floor.
Right. But I'm just saying, I feel like that's going to be more possible for him if we're all moving quite a bit and, you know, in a sexual mood as opposed to, you know, doing the Jesse Ware sleeping in the club thing.
You will always find a way to come for Jesse Ware's album. You are
honestly
such a cut.
I had no intention of harping on this for years and years as I have, but she brought it up on a podcast once and said, and she was like, and Lewis said that I was sleeping in the club. And now I'm like hyper amped. I'm like, this makes you notice me? Anyway, it's like Nurse Betty. I'm crazed. Yeah.
I have never felt more energized than when I saw her live, though, by the way. So
no, she's fucking cool. Also, I was surprised to hear her on a podcast multiple times, which means she has some semblance of a personality. So
well, she's
way ahead of the game in most ways.
She has a podcast about cooking.
Which is so Nena Cherry of her.
You know, we could launch a cooking offshoot of Keep It, but I'm sure Crooked Media already has 6 cooking podcasts in development.
Also, I can't cook, so yeah, you do not like, I'm going to Fire Island in a couple weeks and we're divvying up dinner duties and they're like, all right, Lewis, what day will you take? I'm like, I am going to be going to the pantry. You guys will starve. I need to not do this.
I would never trust you to cook unless there was a rat underneath your hat.
Yeah. No, right. There needs to be some magical realism, otherwise you're not getting a fucking soup or whatever.
What are we gonna get, ham sandwiches?
Even I wouldn't even know what bread to get.
This is the specific thing about Drake where it's he will like discover a genre and you know, sort of like vulture it, and it's shocking actually that, you know, like this is just like sort of like a Black American album, like it's a house album, so it's like it's digging into these roots, and you know, it's like one of the first times he's done that instead of trying to be British or some grime rapper or what, or, you know, like trying to act like he's from the islands just because he's in love with Rihanna.
Right. I remember, it's always fresh on my mind that he has that Aaliyah tattoo. That is both key to me in terms of realizing why his potential for cool and also potential to just be a boring guy who's into hot girls, and that's his whole vibe. Anyway.
Yeah, having an Aaliyah tattoo is actually maybe one of the like coolest and uncoolest things about him.
Right, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
God love Aaliyah's music, by the way. You know who I think should have a house era? And maybe people are going to throw fruit at me. Mm. I don't know. Bruno Mars, because he's already dipped into that era with the 24 karat gold, whatever, that Michel Indigeocello famously called a pastiche and wondered if it was art at all. But anyway, I feel like he dances, you know, well enough that his version of house would be fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm trying to think of who I would like to see do a house album. I will say, you know, that like...
Besides Reba.
The Black Eyed Peas,
that they would have to regenerate. They are as you know, primordial slime. Well, and they would have to come back up through the sewer to life.
They have a new song with Shakira called Don't You Worry.
Oh, speaking of Shakira, I assume you watched the J-Lo documentary on Netflix. And documentary, I am putting in quotes within quotes.
It is not a documentary.
The blowjob of all time. Yes.
It is. It is giving TikToks and Instagram stories that were recorded while she was on the Hustlers press tour.
Right. Yes. And okay, here's the thing. It's actually a pretty fascinating document just to see what goes into being J-Lo, of course. You know, it's a ton of work, and she is an underrated actress in certain ways, and it gets directly into her not getting the Oscar nomination for Hustlers, a movie that she dominated, that she was definitely the best part of, that it would have been a fine nomination and a fun nomination for the category.
She was cinema for a year. Like, yes. I'm sorry, like, everyone was talking about J-Lo, whether you liked it or didn't like it, or thought it was underrated, or you were like, her getting an Oscar? Like, everyone was talking about J-Lo that year.
Totally. And instead, we gave it to Kathy Bates for a performance in which she didn't even try. So it's a strange year.
Do you think Kathy Bates remembers being in Richard Jewell?
No, please. She barely even looked at the check. I don't even think she knows what she got paid for it. She was too busy getting 100 texts from Ryan Murphy a minute. She can't pay attention to that. But anyway, it gets into what I think is the problem with J-Lo generally. Not that she's not a dynamic entertainer. We obviously saw her in Vegas. Wonderful songs. Waiting for Tonight is eternal. Her entire persona, as she outlines in the prep for the halftime show, she's like, oh, well, we got to have like pop era J-Lo, then we got to get I'm Still Here J-Lo, and then also mom J-Lo. That's not a persona. Her whole thing is, I wanted to be a star, and now it's, you can't make me not be a star. There has to be a little bit of meaning somewhere in the middle, and I think J-Lo ultimately doesn't really know what she stands for.
Mm-hmm. She stands for everything.
See, she stands for whatever's nice.
Yeah, and you get that in her movies where, you know, she's always like playing a nice sort of white woman.
A nice sort of white woman starring
with,
J-Lo.
With a white husband. You know, it's every movie, you know. It's
except nice except sort of she, white woman.
Except where she has to be Latina for the plot.
Right. Yes, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. I haven't watched Selena recently. I assume that's still like at least an A-minus performance.
It's good. And I mean, listen, I thought Encanto was good.
I also did watch Marry Me in the past few months, and I do have to say I wish I watched anything else.
Yeah, Marry Me's abysmal.
What was the good part is my question. What was the thing they wanted me to tune into?
Maluma.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Maluma getting to be just a true bastard was an interesting career choice for him. I like it.
I like that for him. Can't act, but...
No.
Beautiful to look
Does
at.
Have sunglasses, and I believe is like 5'1".
And has presence.
Yes.
You know, I mean, is the presence that...
Facial symmetry.
Is the presence that gays were obsessed with him? I don't know. I will say lastly on this Drake, the Drake and Beyonce-ness, everyone, like, obviously, on, like, you know, like, people beat a joke to death now, you know, and, like, the whole joke now is, like, Drake made the album for the gays, it's for the faggots. And I'm like, all right, girl, he made some house music, and you all think that it's for you, because you do ketamine while listening to Honey Dijon remixes in a warehouse.
Right.
But Drake wasn't thinking about you for this album.
To me, it's not a gay album at all. I mean, I say that not to say that he doesn't like gay people or whatever, but it doesn't remind me of clubby good times. It's like a play on club music.
Mm-hmm. But Beyonce? Oh, this is for the sisters.
Oh, please. No, this song should be belted during Pride Month by a drag queen on the top of a 7-Eleven. I mean...
And she just understands the whole assignment, because it's not just the Robin S sample. It's almost a sort of like Queen Latifah-esque like rap in the center. It reminds me of like my favorite Queen Latifah house song, like Come Into My House.
I don't know it. I'm surprised to say I don't know it.
It's such a good song. You should listen to it. And the choir at the end, like it's just, and of course, Big Frida. Because look, it's not just 90s house revival, it's also bounce music. And that moment at the end where Beyonce's like singing in the bridge, like, first of all, she also said, I'm bringing back music with a real music length.
Yes. Yes, please. Thank you.
When she's done and then the beat sort of like falls out for a second and then picks back up, and Big Frida is like chanting again. I'm like, this feels like a song, and it feels like an arrival, and it feels like, I don't know, it felt like when Formation dropped, you know, and you felt like, okay, Beyonce's going in a new direction, but like, I know which direction she's going in.
I feel like by the time this episode drops, the video will be out too, which is better be as thrilling. Because I have to tell you, you just brought up Formation. I am still not over how good a video that is.
It's her best video.
In terms of what she's performing, she plays both like the lady of the manor in that video, the girl with her hair out the window, just the layer. I mean, just it reminds me of, I'm sorry to say, like the best of Madonna, you know? Mm-hmm. And I almost never feel that way when I watch music videos. You know, it's usually like Janet did it, Bjork had it. And now I think Beyonce and Lady Gaga are that level in terms of music video artistry.
Yeah, my biggest regret is that as much as I feel like the throne is basically ready for Dua and Doja Cat, Doja Cat's the more interesting one to me, but God, their videos are so fucking boring.
Right, it's just kind of like down the line, like they're pretty good. That Dua Lipa video where she's in like the seafood restaurant, ma'am, I do not know. Who storyboarded this?
I will say Alpha I like Hitchcock? Doja's yeah. Vegas video.
Yes. I mean, I like her.
I like the song, but the video is just there.
The thing about Nicki Minaj, if you're going to be legitimately funny, we have no choice but to sign on. Like, okay, actually, funny puts you head and shoulders above other people.
Actually, you know what? That's who I want a house album from.
There we go.
Nicki.
I mean, I would love... Yes. I don't love her albums in general, so this would be great.
I think with that layered, with also like her just being funny, I think like that would be the album that Drake wanted to make, or could never make, actually, to be honest. Because he's lost his sort of like sense of humor.
Yes. Yes. It wasn't giving me ebullience.
There's a reason we call him the male Taylor Swift, you know? They're funny sometimes, but they're also a little bit too self-serious to be funny.
Right, and it's constantly telegraphing, but I'm in on the joke, but I'm funny in addition to being serious, and it's a hard mix for them. Taylor Swift generally has that problem. Anyway,
when we're back, Joel talks to us about that island we're going to, and I'm not talking about Dr. Moreau's.
Oh, we should though.
Uh-oh. My name is Sarah, and I got involved with Vote Save America way back in 2018 when it first launched.
My name is Nancy, and I first got involved in VSA in 2018.
Ever since then, Vote Save America has been the best part of my political engagement. Anytime the election anxiety starts to feel overwhelming, I remind myself that my anxiety relief program donation is fueling grassroots organizations around the country.
And VSA has the Political Action Finder, a handy website I've used to find phone banks, knowing that I'm helping to win critical House seats.
In fact, I already signed up to volunteer with the Political Action Finder on the VSA website and helped replace disgraced former volleyball star George Santos.
So if you're someone who doesn't want to wake up on November 6th this year and regret not doing more, and I'm pretty sure you are, go to votesaveamerica.com to get started, and I'll see you at a phone bank soon.
This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Our guest this week is the writer and star of Hulu's Fire Island, and we have never met him before. He's never been on Keep It before. Both of these are lies. Welcome back to Keep It, Joel Kim Booster. Joel, I just remembered you were on our show when we did an episode at Bonnaroo.
At Bonnaroo. Absolute chaos.
Which, but I think, like, if we put all our demographics together and they're already interrelated, the one place we shouldn't be is Bonnaroo. So congrats to all of us for being there.
Yeah. It was, I believe that night we saw Eminem in concert,
right.
Which is definitely, you know, a number one bucket list item for all of us.
And for Eminem. He was like, oh, please tell me they're there.
Okay. Three faggots in the audience. He was very excited.
Now, of course, Ira and I both fucking love Fire Island. Since we know you, we've heard updates about it for years and years. Such a pleasure to finally see it. Obviously, I have hundreds of questions, even though tons of all of our mutual friends are in it. And my first question is regarding that, which is, obviously, you could have made this movie if you just cast people you had never met before. But how important was it for you to make this movie with friends? And what did it add to have your actual friends in the movie?
So, you know, from the jump, it was always going to be a movie that was sort of honoring my friendship with Bowen. Like, that was first and foremost sort of the plan. Like, I set out to write sort of a story about our friendship. Like, so much of the movie is ripped from the headlines of our friendship. And that was always, like, from the very beginning, he was attached. And that was the only friend that I knew was going to be in the movie. And beyond that, like, it really did come down to people auditioning and, like, who was best for the role. Because, like, you know, we know this. I know every gay person in this industry. We right. all do. We know every gay, funny person in this industry. And I would have loved to cast truly all of them. But it was like a calculus of, like, who works together and, like, what does this friend group look like and how, what is the texture of the friend group? And so we really, the only other friend that I was able to cast in this movie in sort of the main parts was Matt Rogers, who, you know, I wrote like sort of a toxic, annoying gay person. And and that was always earmarked for Matt.
Right.
And it was one of those things where all he had to do was like not fuck up the audition, and it was his. And, you know, he nailed it, of course. So that was like, so it was really nice to have the three of them on set. It was like a very grounding presence, because obviously it was like there's a lot of pressure going into making this movie for gay people, making this movie as like sort of, you know, one of the, you know, big gay rom-coms that's coming out this year. It was a lot of pressure, and it was just nice to have like two of my best friends on set just like sort of reminding me that it should be fun, you know. Mm-hmm. It should be fun, and it should be like and not like it's not the this lower
we're
on set with me.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to ask about Fire Island and it being, you know, this adaptation is, you know, your brand is being funny, your brand is also being hot, as you say in your stand-up special Psychosexual, which we will get to that as well. But this is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. There's also this lovely plot point in the film, you know, where two of the characters sort of bond over like an Alice Munro book.
Yeah.
You know, so like, is reading part of your brand too? Or like, what was like the Jane Austen of it all that even got you to want to like adapt it in the first place? And like, what does like literature mean like as a part of your whole like culture world?
Yeah, no, I mean, reading is a big part of my life. I think like it's definitely not like the front and center, like marquee part of my personality that I put out there. Like, I haven't figured out a way to make reading an interesting point to bring up in my stand up, you know? Like, I think it's not necessarily like there's not really an outlet for that. But yeah, I'm a big reader, and it's definitely like a big part of my personality. I don't think it's like something that a lot of people know about me unless they like clock me reading a book at Palm Springs or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I the whole genesis of this movie was me bringing Pride and Prejudice to read on Fire Island, the first trip that we ever took with Bowen, you know, like that's where the whole thing started. And like, I wanted to try and infuse this character with like complications. Cause you know, like, listen, I've read a lot of critiques of the movie that are like, oh, this character is just a stereotype, just a typical, you know, frivolous gay guy who wants to have sex and do drugs and all of this stuff. And I'm always like, did they not see the Alice Monroe scene? Like, like, yes, I'm a stereotype, but there's also more dimensions, I think, beyond like, stereotypes exist because in part they are real, you know, like gay guys like that exist. But I think the problem with stereotypes is when we don't move beyond them. Like, we all three in this in our little Zoom boxes probably all sort of exemplify some version of gay stereotypes to a degree, but we also have dimensions beyond that that sort of complicate those stereotypes. And that's what I really wanted to do with the movie, is complicate the stereotypes a little bit. Because like, when I hear like, what is a stereotypical gay guy, I do recognize a lot of my friends, but then I also recognize that there are so many other things that make us more interesting beyond those things. So yeah, reading was an important, I wanted to make sure that I honored, you know, that part of my personality and infused the movie a little bit with that.
Do you see other people with books on Fire Island?
Yeah, you do see a couple people. Like, the people that I go with, like, we're all hot gay guys who read. Like, that is, and it's infuriating, but it is, that is like a big part of, I think, everybody's trip is figuring out like what the beach read is, like who's bringing, you know, like conversations with friends versus like who's bringing some like, you know, a nonfiction essay book about gentrification. You know, it is like, it runs the gamut.
I just want to say, when I hear critiques about gay stereotypes, it's like, you know, there isn't a straight character in any movie that doesn't resemble a stereotype of some kind, right? There's this special stigma reserved for gay people having any recognizably common traits that we're all supposed to be afraid of. It's like, it's 2022. Gay people like having things in common, first of all. And two, when this call comes from inside the house and it's gay people being like, oh, that's just a stereotype, I think what they're not admitting is that there's a certain comfort in not being represented in movies. And then when you finally see it on screen, you want to shrug it off. You want to say, oh, no, that's not me at all, because you've been sort of luxuriating in feeling unknowable a little bit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like, it's hard for us to see ourselves represented on screen because we're so used to having to cobble together representation from like 15 different actresses, you know, like that's what we like, we're used to sort of projecting on our own experience onto other, you know, queering, you know, non-queer movies. That has been, you know, how we've navigated the representation game for so long. And then to see it sort of like baldly laid out as like, this should be you, this is reflecting your experience, I get why it sort of like rankles people initially, like, oh my God, that's not me. And I think it's weird that we're not afforded the same, I don't know, grace as like, you know, when people are like, oh, I see myself in Rooney Mara, even though it's nothing like your experience. It's like, give me the same grace as Rooney Mara. That's, you know, put it on a t-shirt. But
did you know that Rooney Mara was supposed to be the star of Vox Lux?
Really?
Yes, which makes sense because the daughter character in it, who like she grows up to be or whatever, looks exactly like Rooney Mara.
Exactly, Rooney Mara. Yeah.
Anyway, well, important note.
As a Natalie stan, I'm glad that we live in this timeline.
Now, I want to say also just quickly about the island of Fire Island. There's a lot of things this movie just does journalistically to sell what it is, like the experience of being there, that like, I don't think even I would have guessed about had I not finally gone last year. Were there favorite parts of the Fire Island experience that you're glad are now committed to celluloid that now people can just reach to and say, oh, that's correct. That happens at Fire Island.
You know what? I think my favorite aspect, because like the thing is about Fire Island is you're dipping in and out of these like parties to then this like incredible natural beauty that is surrounding you. Like the thing is about Fire Island is yes, it's all gay and yes, it's like there's the parties and all of that stuff, but it's also like incredibly beautiful to be there. Like there's so many like visually arresting moments, and the number one for me is like going from tea, like being all like fucked up at tea, and then traipsing on down to the boardwalk or the dock to see the sunset. Like that is my favorite moment of every Fire Island trip, is watching the sunset from that dock and like getting to have two very different versions of that experience in the movie was so important to me, because those are the moments where it's like that dichotomy of like, oh, we were just like surrounded by gay men with their shirts up, listening to bad pop music, drinking. And now we're like sitting watching like one of the most beautiful sunsets you'll ever see, like surrounded by your best friends. Like it is those sorts of moments that really make the island really, really special to me.
I mean, I'm going for the first time for the 4th of July, so I'm like looking forward to like finding out, you know, what's representative versus you know, what I get to experience myself. But like, I love that of what you were just describing. You know, I feel like one thing I really enjoy about your comedy and just sort of your writing is just sort of like, it's very frankness about like just who you are as a person. And, you know, you'll make jokes, you know, about sex, but you'll make jokes about like doing ketamine and other things like that. And I feel like those are moments that can, you know, be like, oh, you know, you're talking about a party culture, but there can also be moments that lead to, you know, a beautiful moment, like still being awake, you know, like to see like the sunrise, you know, like I thought about that recently. I was just in Barcelona for this music festival, you know, and I was there with friends and, you know, we're like, we were doing drugs and shit. But then like it ends with, it's like 7 a.m. and you get to walk to the beach in Barcelona and you're watching the sunrise. And it's like, I think those are some of the beautiful moments that people miss out when they think that people are just sort of writing about and representing like toxic sort of gay drug culture on film.
Yeah. And the thing is too, like, I always want to like preface my comedy, like, I'm not trying to sell people on my lifestyle. I'm just like, I'm not interested in like hiding parts of myself to like only like sell one part of my life. Like, I'm not like, when I talk about ketamine on stage, it's because I had a funny thought. It's not because I think everyone should be doing ketamine, or even there's, I try to like take the judgment of the lifestyle out of it, because it's just not like, it's just a part of my life. And so like, if I have a, like every comic gets to talk about their lives in, you know, whatever funny take they have. But for some reason, it's like a little more loaded when I do it, because it's like, oh, I'm gay, and so now everyone thinks gay people are going to be doing ketamine. And that's not our problem to fix. Like if a straight person watches my act and walks away and thinks like, wow, are all gay people vapid party monsters? Like that's not, if all it took was one stand-up set to get a straight person to think that, that's not a problem. That's a straight problem. That is a straight issue to fix, not ours, you know. And that's why I'm so frustrated sometimes when I see gay people like feeding into that.
You just brought up audiences in general, which is something I wanted to talk about. It feels like it's a recent phenomenon that a gay comic could go and perform, and most of the time the audience will be filled maybe with queer people, maybe some straight women too. But do you cherish that demographic in particular? Like when you perform, are you grateful to see a room full of gay people? Or are you like, oh, I wish it was more mixed or something? I don't know.
It depends. So like, it's interesting. I'm in San Diego right now doing shows. And last night, I think because of the movie's release, like I'm still at this point in my career. And when I go to comedy clubs, like it is maybe 50% of people there to see me and 50% people who are there because they like the club or they just wanted to go out for a fun night. And so like, I am often performing for a very, very mixed crowd of people. And, you know, I don't really adjust my set for the straight people in the audience, but I will say last night was the first time I think there were maybe three straight guys. Like we did like a poll because one of my openers was a straight man and he went out and he was doing his regular set and it wasn't necessarily working because the audience was of like 200 people. There were only 3 straight men in the audience. And it was so interesting because he came backstage and he was like, I've never felt so nervous and so scared doing stand-up in years and years and years. And I was like, you realize that is how I feel every time I go up to a predominantly straight audience, like trying to figure out like if my references are going to hit, like if I should, what I should adjust and how I should like deal with that. And it's like, it was so interesting to me to see a straight person experience that for the very first time. I will say, and this is something that Guy Branum has said a lot, and I do think it's changing with our generation, but like when I perform on say like a gay cruise to mostly older gay men who are sort of, you know, Gen X and above, it is a little difficult because I do find that gay men are much more judgmental of other gay men than they are of maybe a female comedian, you know, like Guy Branum said it, you know, like most gay men, like unless they can completely sexualize you and are watching you as like a go-go boy or a stripper or completely desexualize you as like a drag queen, they don't know how to interact with gay men while they're watching them on stage, you know, and even in movies. And I think that's part of what we're seeing, like from the reaction to Fire Island too, is that there's a certain level of like, not, we are not used, we do not have the training because we're just now seeing representation. We don't know how to interact with ourselves on screen or as representatives. So when like I do a gay cruise, it's so funny because like they want Kathy Griffin, they don't want me, you know? And so I sometimes get more nervous in front of gay audiences than I do in front of straight audiences.
I have to tell you, I'm not curious to see Kathy Griffin on Ketamine. I love the woman to death. I just think that would be bad news for a lot of us. Couldn't love her more, honestly. I just think it means danger.
That's what she was on when she did the Trump photo.
I know. Yeah. That's right.
I mean, well, speaking of representation and like straight people and audiences, one bit that you have in your Netflix special, Psychosexual, is, you know, as you point out this straight white guy, Ben, and like get his reactions during your show. And I want to also ask about, you mentioned that, you know, like you're a person who like reads the comments a lot. And, you know, I assume you still did that with Fire Island, you know, like how do you sort of get in your mind, you know, when you're working on something or just maybe once it comes out, you know, you're thinking about like, I'm thinking about how gay people are going to be responding to this. And then also the idea, like I'm thinking about how like Asian people are going to respond to this, you know, particularly I love in your Vulture interview, you know, you talk about, you know, like how you didn't need like a medal for casting like an Asian love interest, but you know, like, with the film and then like, you know, with your jokes, you know, about your very lovely boyfriend who we love, you know, he's fantastic, you know, but like, are you in your mind thinking about, you know, like I'm making these jokes, you know, about like whiteness and representation and culture and like people are still gonna like point out like, but he has a white boyfriend, or if Conrad hadn't been cast in the film, they'd be pointing out like, okay, but the love interest is white. Like, is that something you're thinking about constantly?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely thinking about it a lot. And I this is the thing, is that like I really do appreciate engaging with criticism in my work, you know, like I think a large part of the special is response to criticism that I've received from all corners of, you know, identity, like from Asian people, from gay people, from straight people, you know, like it's interesting for me to engage with the good faith critiques, I think, of my work. There's definitely tons of bad faith critiques that I think ascribe like negative intention to me as a person, that like it's easy to dismiss that. But I am definitely like, I'm constantly thinking about the ways in which I'm perceived as a comedian to try and like not stay ahead of it, but just also like, it's, I think it's useful to know like how people are absorbing your work and like how you're being perceived. But I will say there is like a fine line, and it can drive you a little crazy. Like Andrew on the set of the movie, I would like spin out constantly about like, oh, how is this going to be perceived? How is this going to be taken? And he would just like sort of like put his hand on my shoulder and be like, Joel, you cannot write this movie for Twitter. You can't do it. You like, if you like, it's a losing game to try and stay ahead of whatever the discourse is going to be on Twitter, a very small subsection of the people that are actually going to watch this movie. And you just have to try and tell like an honest story. And so it is like a fine line. Oftentimes I do find like especially with regard to the special, like, it is my special, this hour special is like a direct response to commentary around my work previous to this, because it's frustrations around like the representation conversation in general. Like, it is so frustrating for me that I cannot just tell a joke in a vacuum and like have it be judged on the merits of whether or not it makes this person laugh or not, which is like what most straight white guys get to go out there and make their jokes, and the only metric it's judged on is if people laugh or not. Like, for me though, it's like, am I representing Asian people? Am I representing gay people well? You know, and it's so frustrating, and it's like such a double-edged sword, because I get people come up to me all the time and they're like, oh, thank you for representing our community, thank you for being a representative, and it's like, it makes me so stressed out, because I'm like, that's not what I want to do necessarily. Like, I wish there were dozens of me out there so that like I was just one other face in a sea of gay Asian comedians, so that, you know, it's not like on me to try and be the best representative that I can be for this community. And I'm lucky that there are more and more and more of us coming up right now. Like, I can name a bunch of them. Like, there's like so many, like Jess Tom is somebody that comes to mind, who I think is an amazing comedian who's also doing a lot of the similar work. Obviously Bowen is in the same space as I am, but it's like, I just wish that, like, it's the scarcity politics of it, because I think the mainstream like industry is like sort of presenting me as the answer for like, oh, you said you weren't represented enough, well, here's Joel Kim Booster. And it's like, no, there has to be more than one of me. Like, if I'm being pushed in front of people, like, of course there's going to be resentment from certain like corners of the Asian community or the gay community who don't see themselves represented in my work. Like, and again, it's not like my problem, and it's not even necessarily like gay people or Asian people's problems. It's the mainstream like Hollywood narrative like saying that is the problem.
Now, speaking of that kind of stress, it feels to me like at this particular juncture, you're poised to, I don't know about do what you want, but do one of a number of things. Like, I'm sure people want you to make a sequel to this, or follow it up with something similar, or you can probably act in what you want to do, or, you know, there's any number of options. And I was wondering, is that exciting or just a new version of stress, having to navigate where you quote unquote belong after this?
Yeah, it's my bad brain like is full of anxiety now. I think it's I wish I could just enjoy this moment a little bit more, but like previous to the movie coming out, I was like, oh my God, everyone's going to hate this. No one's going to like this. No one's going to like this. And now that it's come out and the reception has been mostly positive, all I can think of is like, well, whatever you do next is going to be shit. It will never amount to this. Like, it'll never be as good as like what Fire Island or whatever you've just done. And so I'm trying to just like take a step back and like really assess like what I actually want to do next and like what I actually want to write next. I think like a sequel is such a funny idea to me, and it's exciting, but it's also like, I don't necessarily want to be known as the gay destination vacation writer for the rest of my career. I'd like to maybe pivot into something else. So I'm just trying to figure out like what even the options are, because this is the thing, like, I've been here before. Like, I think right around the same time I was on the show last time, I was like poised to be on an NBC sitcom, and people were like, this is it. This is going to change your life. And then that show flopped hard, and, you know, nothing really changed. And so I'm very weary of being like, yeah, like when people say like, this is it, this is going to change everything for you, I'm sort of like, I'm going to like sort of wait and see, and I'll believe it when I see it sort of vibe.
Let me just say about destination cinema though, if you merged with the Best Exotic Marigold franchise, I feel like everybody wins. You and Maggie, yes. You know, long stairs, sideways stairs, it speaks to me.
Exactly where I need to go.
You know what, I do want to see a gay cruise something though, because you made Fire Island look amazing. You made Fire Island look beautiful, and I can't wait to go, but I am iffy on cruises, gay or not. And I feel like maybe you could change my mind.
I'm definitely going to do like the gay remake of Murder on the Nile, but Atlantis.
Yeah,
you know, like that's the next move. Is because I have actually always wanted to solve a murder on a cruise, like just in my personal life, and so I think like you know, that's definitely, I think, the next move for me is Murder on an Atlantis Cruise, for sure.
Also, because then you could have Sophie Okonedo's character in Death on the Nile be the entertainment on the gay cruise.
Yeah.
Like, she would still be that person.
Yeah. And you could get Gal Gadot to say something like, I don't know, there's enough poppers to fill the Nile.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, that would just be true. It would just be true. Yeah.
It would actually be true. I will say, like, the gay cruises, the wildest people, they get the wildest people to perform. Like, every time I've gone, it's like, yeah, the entertainment this week is Leanne Rimes. And it's like, how the fuck did you get Leanne Rimes to come on this gay cruise? And then you see, like, a stadium full of gay men chanting Leanne's name, and you're like, oh, this is how you get Leanne Rimes. Like, this is like, I was the first cruise I ever did. Vanessa Williams came on, and I was like, how did they get Vanessa Williams to do a gay cruise? And then she comes out for her performance, and she's like, I'm not doing any covers tonight. I'm only doing originals. And I was like, well, this is how. This is how you get Vanessa Williams to do the gay cruise. It's the only place where you could fill a stadium full of people to listen to her original songs.
Wow. You got a lot of moody prog rock or something from Vanessa Williams? That's too bad. Yeah.
You're like, no colors of the wind? Seriously? Okay.
All right, I get it. Gay cruises are the soap dish mall scene for all female performers.
Good sell.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, Joel. And congrats on Fire Island.
I appreciate that. I will see you both on Fire Island.
And also, probably just everywhere else, I have bad news for you. So.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
I believe it was JFK who once said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country while it tries to pick its next very old president, hopefully the one that's not the monster. Pretty wordy, that guy. The point is, new tour dates and cities just dropped. Love It or Leave It is heading out on the road. We will be hitting Austin, Washington, D.C., Charlotte, North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina, Boston, Madison, Chicago, Pittsburgh. Come say hi. We got some great shows planned, John.
Yes, I'm excited.
Thanks. Thanks. To learn more, get tickets, head to crooked.com/events.
I don't know how I can improve on that.
crooked.com/events.
The Wendy Williams Show recently came to an end after a 13-year run, but the host herself was not a part of the final episode. And Lewis, how you doing? Because I'm not doing great.
I mean, that does make me really sad. It gives me the vibes of Angela Lansbury not being at the Tonys. I want to know more. You know, obviously she has Graves' disease, has had it for a couple years, has been out of the spotlight. And Wendy Williams loves broadcasting herself in any form possible. So that is very suspicious.
Yeah, it's, I feel like, you know, like, you know more about, you know, like, talk show and sort of like history, etc. You know, this is so unusual. So, like, yes, for the show to one, even keep going, and then for it to just end without her there.
Yes, and with the first guest on the Wendy Williams Show, who was Vanessa Williams. Mm-hmm. Very puzzling. I would just want to say about her in general, she's routinely compared to somebody like Howard Stern because she came from radio and is, you know, meant to be shocking. But what she really is a devious Rosie O'Donnell, because her whole thing is obsessiveness about celebrity, knowing everything, and immediately like going live to camera to say what she thinks about the celebrity thing, talking to other like-minded people, which I thought was one of the great thrills of the Rosie O'Donnell Show. It felt sort of conspiratorial with, you know, a tabloid loving audience. And there are times on that show when she would just break down whatever issue, and it would be so thrilling to hear her talk about Beyonce and Jay-Z's What's Coming to Mind. And obviously she had some wild statements over the years. bizarre statements. What's coming to mind is when she said that, I think, Terry Crews being groped was not actual groping. Like, she would just come to wild conclusions about seemingly cut and dry situations. But my God, when she was on. And when she was off, she was downright enigmatic.
Yeah, I will say that I agree with like not lumping her in with like a Howard Stern, only because there's a thing about like male sort of like interviewers where they haven't had to be sort of very knowledgeable. You know, to put it lightly, you know, like right. It reminds me of sort of like Larry King, like famously just interviewing people and not doing a lick of research, you know?
Larry King, I think history will remember him as, I don't want to say a fraud, but I think it might remember him as someone we shouldn't have given so much kind of prestige cable time slot time to.
A scamstress, if you will.
Yeah, scamstress, yeah.
You know, I think it was the suspenders and those glasses. And definitely the hair.
Right. Yes. We just believed it for some reason, even though he would have, whatever, Kathy Griffin on and just go to sleep for 25 minutes while she ranted about Nicole Kidman.
Another sort of person who I think is in line with Wendy, just because, you know, Wendy and Kathy, you know, share that sort of like oratory skill of, you know, you give them one topic and if you left the room and came back, like you went to the grocery store to get cigarettes and liquor and like cups and like ice for the party and came back, she would still be on that same topic telling that story and people would be enraptured.
Right. No, I love when they would cut to the audience on Wendy Williams and people are truly like tugging at their collars like the white guy in the Baby Got Back video.
She could truly just like come out, sit down. My favorite thing is how like her version of the monologue was she'd come out, she'd talk about something. She'd just sit with the audience talking for like 15 minutes uninterrupted.
Right. And it didn't seem really planned either. Actually, that's sort of like Kathy Griffin. Kathy Griffin, when she would do stand up for a long time, would pick bullet points and then just talk through them. And maybe she had a pre-planned joke here or there, but really it was about whatever comes to mind will come to mind and I'm going to let it kind of unspool in front of everybody. And that was Wendy's tactic too.
And the thing is she, like, I talked about this on the For Colored Nerds podcast too, but it was like, the thing is that she had like a, she had respect of like people in the industry, you know? Like she, obviously you had to be able to have all this gossip, you know, for people to be telling you things, you know? It's like, I think about Hollywood Life, right? Like when they were like, the queen is dead. If Wendy Williams told us the queen is dead on her show, like, I'm believing it.
Right.
Because she knows. My God. I would fully believe that she has a line at Buckingham.
I just want everybody to know that my first job in L.A. was a different version of Hollywood Life, which I guess still exists with, what's that woman's name, Bonnie Fuller at the helm. Man, when I go back and look at that site, what? I mean, oh what? It's
I meant Hollywood Unlocked. Site. I meant Hollywood Unlocked, but yes, Hollywood Life and those, the era of like the Hollywood Life and Pop Sugar.
Right. Pop Sugar, I felt like at least keeps, they're just like plugging along. They're it's on the rails anyway. But what's weird about Pop Sugar, it's founded by somebody whose last name is Sugar. Isn't that fucking insane? Oh. It's like the Smart and Final chain out here in LA, which is a grocery store, is founded by two people whose last names are Smart and Final.
I did not know that.
That's really bone chilling.
Smart versus Final. I want to see that. Smart v. Final. Where's that film?
Dustin Hoffman, Meryl Streep, Smart v. Final.
I guess I will be forever grateful that, you know, I was part of the Wendy Williams legacy. That
oh, yeah,
I
you went on the show.
I went on the show and I was talking, I was DMing with our friend Michelle Collins because she was like, oh, you'd inspired me to like post my Hot Topics like panel too. And she talked about, you know, how like just how supportive Wendy was to her, you know, especially when she was going through her stuff on The View. And, you know, when she was so sweet. And like I discovered that the photo I had taken with her, the selfie, was alive. Photo, and in it is where she had told me, like, as we're both posing, she like leans back and says, "You're coming back." You know, like the fact that like she enjoyed me on the show and wanted me to come back, like that means a lot to me. And I was talking to Michelle just about the fact that like basically the pandemic happened like 2 months, like a month after I was on, and so I wasn't able to come back. But like we were robbed of the chance of being on the show together. I would love to really be on Wendy Williams with Michelle Collins.
Oh my God. Also, Michelle Collins really is in line with Wendy Williams in terms of like, listen, I know everything and you may as well just listen to me because I'm not going to shut up about it. You know, listen, I mean, like she just, yeah.
We have never, there's like sometimes when you have like a keeping guest too and they've been like a guest or they've been like a guest co-host, it's like there's always that balance of like, you know, like matching our energy and, you know, like not like doing too little but not doing the most, but like when Michelle was just talking, I'm just like, girl, keep talking. I want to know more.
Right, please. No, I go into lizard brain. I just accept everything she says. And I'm like, yes, more of that, please. By the way, she was fucking amazing on The View. I know I've said that before.
She was.
But that was an era I watched. God, no, she was so fucking funny. I remember one, I'm sure I've said this before. Somebody on the show said, I don't like going to museums. Like, I just want to leave and go get a slice of pizza. And Michelle, without skipping a beat, deadpan to her face goes, you're a monster.
I was excited.
The Barnard bitch and Michelle Collins.
That is also what I feel like The View is missing, by the way. Like, no one on the panel is really funny at the moment. Whoopi sort of is. You know, Whoopi is mostly
just exasperated.
She's exasperated now. She's tired of this. She's too old for this shit.
Yeah,
The View is her lethal weapon. And she's Danny Glover.
Her good friend. But I want to sum up Wendy Williams by saying, I guess my perspective on her is in line with her whole Whitney Houston sort of obsession, which is she reported generally accurately on Whitney Houston, but also it was extremely dicey. And she also would beg Whitney Houston to come on her show, which she eventually did. And it was the most uncomfortable yet like compulsively listenable conversation of all time.
I still listen to that. There's so much wrapped into
the ball of fury that is Wendy Williams. There's no second one of her.
I still listen to that all the fucking time. And I'm like, truly, we always go back to like, you know, the Diane Sawyer Whitney interview,
right.
you know, like crack is whack, crack is cheap, you know, like that interview. But more people need to be on the Wendy Williams one where she says she will come down to the studio and whoop Wendy's ass.
And by the way, I've never believed a human being more. Okay.
Yeah. And then I think they mended the fences sort of later too, you know? I think Whitney sort of recognized that like Wendy was reporting accurately, you know?
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, of course she was reporting accurately. But,
yeah. That was our Frost Nixon, by the way. Whitney and Wendy.
The real Frost Nixon? Yeah.
The real Frost Nixon. Fuck Frost Nixon. What the fuck did Frost Nixon even do?
No.
I guess it revealed Watergate.
Whatever. Yeah. it gave Frank Langella a platform, and he has since been deplatformed via Me Too. So whatever.
Who plays Whitney and who plays Wendy in the Frost Nixon like depiction of their interview?
Okay, so Whitney would have to be like 37 or something. So we're saying if it's like filmed today.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Well, you know, who's playing her in the upcoming Whitney biopic?
Oh, right. I forget that actress's name.
It's Naomi Ackie. And you know what? If she's good in it, like maybe her.
Okay. And then who else? Like, is for Whitney, but that would be to play Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
And then Wendy Williams, God, who can do that kind of rowdy, unmatched energy? I'm trying to think of who that would be.
I know. I'm like, Kiki?
I don't hate it, but I mean, it would take a couple of years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Naomi's like young, giving you like 80s Whitney anyway. So like,
yeah,
give us like 10 years and then I'd be there.
Okay. Very good.
Well, Ciara Payton played her on Lifetime, but the less said about that Lifetime movie, the better.
Yes. Was it even technically a movie? I am inclined to disagree.
I can't think of like people who would sort of be like a successor to her. You know, I'm like Sherry Shepherd, shout out to her getting like her new show, but like that's not going to be a Wendy Williams ass show, you know? And I feel
a part of me is a little bit sad about that. Not because Sherry Shepherd is incapable of hosting a talk show. Obviously, she's from The View and has hosted a number of things, but like
and she was funny too.
And she is funny. And like, I think probably knowledgeable, but she's just not spicy. Like her, she's just a consummate host as opposed to a consummate gossip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you remember the time like she was mad at Dr. Oz because like Dr. Oz like had brought up like, you know, like the custody stuff like going on in her family. And I'm just like, sort of like, someone like a Wendy would have fought back with Dr. Oz on the show. You know, like you need to be afraid of them as well.
Right. Yes. Yes. Definitely. Definitely.
I'm afraid of Angie Jordan, but not Sherry Shepherd.
Certainly. Ham. Of all the 30 Rock quotes, I want to say that comes up the most ultimately. So.
Important. I would say the one that comes up the most, thanks to the toxic internet meme culture, is Lemon, It's Wednesday.
Yes. Oh, my God. Which, that's so the, like, Garfield Mondays of memery from 30 Rock. Disrespect.
Anyway, when we're back, keep it. We're back with our favorite segment of the episode. As always, it's Keep It. Lewis, what's yours?
Well, I'm doing my worst this week because I've ignored most of the regular pop culture that listeners to this podcast likely enjoy. And I've gone with Jeopardy, which I think happens about once every 2 months. But I think it's a good Jeopardy Keep It.
At some point, we're going to have to rank like Lewis's top Jeopardy Keep It. You've got like 20.
Well, I just want to say they've had a couple of years that have been extremely wild. So I've had no choice but to report on it journalistically, Edward R. Murrow style. Okay, this week, there was a final Jeopardy where a contestant who was otherwise killing it, this woman named Sadie, mm-hmm. in the middle podium. The answer
Sadies
was
usually do kill it.
You think so?
Sadies, yeah. You know, it's a good
Sadie
name.
Sadie Hawkins, they're going to ask you to the dance. You don't have to ask her. It was a question about Frederick Douglass talking to somebody else, and via the clues in the final Jeopardy answer, it was apparent it was Harriet Tubman. Okay. Well, she wrote down Harriet Tubman, seemingly getting to it at the last minute, and we'll show this on the Snapchat, hopefully, but the way she wrote Harriet Tubman, the first word, Harriet, that's pretty apparent. The T is crossed. And then in the final word, it says T-U-B-M-A, and then the tail on the A sort of lingers and turns into a hump, which I would argue makes it an N and makes the entire words legible, Harriet Tubman. You can pronounce all the syllables, which is the requirement for a legitimate Jeopardy response. And they declared it an incomplete response, penalized her, and she ended up in third as opposed to winning Jeopardy, which she would have. And I just want to say they better second chance Sadie. I need to see her back on that show, which happens occasionally. They bring back contestants who, because of a technicality or something going wrong in the show, they end up bringing somebody back due to questionable calls, et cetera. But anyway, Ira, I have sent you the picture of this writing of Harriet Tubman. Do you agree with the judges, or do you agree with me?
Well, first of all, I do not want to see Second Chance Sadie, which sounds like a Ballad Ackerman and Ashton Kutcher film from 2004.
Exactly, Malin Ackerman, yes.
And I thought about her recently because two people were watching Ballad Ackerman films like on the plane yesterday, and I was like, how is it possible she's been in two films?
Wait, different ones? Was one of them Rock of Ages?
Yes.
Okay, wow, I can't believe I pulled that. Anyway.
This does not say who was Harriet Tubman, bitch. This is like, who is Harriet Tullness? Harriet Tubness?
Maybe she's asking, who's Harriet Tullness? Does anybody know?
You think Harriet Tubman would look at this and be like, that's my name? Okay.
Picture Harriet Tubman watching Jeopardy and being like, that's not me.
Okay.
I know you meant to bring me up, but that's not
okay.
Me.
I know you think I run like this because you think slaves can't read right, but bitch, I have good penmanship.
Honey, Honey, I've seen a book. Honey, Uncle Tom's Cabin just came out and I read it. Okay?
This is so disgraceful. This is giving like doctor's signature.
Right. And by the way, it's just like, having been on the show, I can say it's like what when you're signing like the credit card thing at Target, that kind of pen. So picture the amount of times you've written in that little blank and it's seen legible. It's just not the ideal pen for writing legibly.
Even the W in her who is shaky, though. Like, she looks terrified. She's giving Woman in the Window. She is giving Ellen Burstyn in Rec Room for a Dream, okay? Her hand is shaking as she wrote who. And then crossing out the H like twice. Sadie was going through it.
There's a whole psychological arc in her who is Harriet Tubman.
Yeah. I'm not giving it to her.
You're not. Okay, so you guys should fight with us about this. Look up the image itself and tell me if you think Sadie deserved the win. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it goes to conservatives, Republicans, the right.
Oh, brave.
This week, yes. It involves the film Lightyear.
Which I have to say, as I'm a Toy Story stan, I still am not excited for.
Yes. So here is the thing.
Okay.
Conservatives are mad because there is a lesbian kiss. You know, the dykes are getting feisty in Lightyear and making out. As it turns out, you know, the plot of the film is that, you know, this is the movie that the Buzz Lightyear toy was made from, and that's what Andy got in the first Toy Story, which is very weird because the movie opens up with this title card. It was like, in 1995, Andy got a Buzz Lightyear toy from his favorite movie. This is that movie. And I'm trying to think of this movie being made in 1995.
It's not reminding me of that era. It's
Where's
not
Morgan
reminding
Freeman?
Me of that era. Yeah. Where's a young Kate Winslet? Where? Yeah. Is Mare Winningham? Is she there?
But
Annabella Sciorra?
The film involves him going back and forth from this planet trying to break like the the speed barrier, and he like keeps passing through time, and you keep seeing these like little like moments in time from like his best friend and fellow space ranger who's on the planet, who meets a woman, you know, they get married, they have a kid, that kid graduates on their 40th anniversary, and then that kid has a daughter. During really one of the 10 second segment, you see a peck. Okay. If you were not looking for it, you would miss it. My friend Drew was sitting right next to me, didn't even see the kiss.
And it reminds me of when Modern Family finally had a kiss, and it was in the background while something else was going on, and you could see it, but you basically have to be told to look for it.
Right. And that's my main problem with this entire situation. One, Disney, you know, even sort of like promoting this kiss in the first place, because it's more crumbs from them. Like the Beauty and the Beast kiss, you know, like that insane moment in Avengers where someone's like talking about losing their partner and they're like, this is the first gay representation in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm like, shut the fuck up. I mean, I feel like the kiss in Eternals was an actual kiss, so I will shout out Eternals for doing that. It's the only thing I'll shout out Eternals for. But I would say that, one, on the Disney side, this is just like, it's useless to promote this. And then on the side of Republicans, you know how, like, they love a culture war that's really right. Just, well, you know, a
the
mass.
Only wars they have, really.
A mass for me.
Oh, actually, the other ones, too. Never mind.
Well, we share that.
Yeah.
we love a good war, too.
That's true. No, that, yeah, you're right. Yeah. All hands on deck.
Okay. Call me a neoliberal, because I love a war. War. What is it good all for? Right. Bringing the country
Fun.
Together.
Yeah.
Winning elections. No, so you've got people like Ted Cruz and shit, you know, going after this movie. You've got people who are probably bots on Twitter just being like, I went to see this movie with my family, and when I saw that kiss, I walked out, and so did other people. I'm like, so, you know, a boycott doesn't involve going to a film to see the point in the movie that you want to object to and then walking out of it, right? Like Disney already has your money.
Yeah, right. If you're in the theater, you've paid for it.
Yeah. And if you're doing it in some sort of protest, like, you know that, like, Disney, the Disney execs can't see you walking out, right? It's not theater.
They're on the other side of the screen. It's like purple. It's like Purple Rose of Cairo. They're looking right at you.
Yeah. And then because the movie did big slay at the box office, you know, now they're tweeting hashtag go woke, go broke.
Okay, that is sad. I hate when they go with wordplay. It's not the witty side of the aisle. You know what I mean?
It is a shitty slogan. And it also goes back to your point that even Toy Story stands don't care about this movie. I went to see it because of the controversy and, like, I wanted to talk about it on the show. And I was just like, whatever. Like, it's a cute way to spend, like, a Saturday afternoon. But I still haven't seen Toy Story 4.
I saw it on a plane, and I was happy for the Bo Peep representation, since she was, you know, unceremoniously dropped from the third one. But it was a lot of running around. I don't know. It felt like maybe a video game of Toy Story as opposed to, like, Toy Story canon. Because among, like, huge franchises, Toy Story is, like, the Yale of, like, blockbuster franchises. Like, who has a record like that? The 1, the 2, and 3. Like, it beats even, like, Back to the Future or something like that. You know, might be up there with Lord of the Rings.
The first three movies are iconic, and they're like, critically lauded. Audiences love them. And, like, yeah, I never got around to seeing 4. And I did just happen to see this film. But it's not like, you know, this was Avengers Endgame, you know? Like, it's not like they picked a film that probably was tracking poorly and wasn't going to make a shit ton of money in the first place. So, like, congrats, I guess you won. But I don't care about this victory against a conglomerate like Disney.
Yes. Yeah. It's just they're making up a reason to have a problem. It's their whole reason for being.
Of course.
Don't want to make anything better. They just want to make somebody feel worse for enjoying something.
Right.
Anyway.
It's annoying homophobia, just like this whole, like, fixation on drag queens at brunch right now. You know, it's just very much like we have to hate people for some reason. And it's wrapped up in their, like, hatred of Disney, for Disney, like, opposing, like, the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida. But it's also just like, it's also the fake anger over Tim Allen allegedly being, like, ousted from this franchise, and, like, Disney turning its back on him, even though Tim Allen is doing a Santa Claus series for Disney.
Right. If anybody is concerned about the money of Tim Allen, I need you to join Earth, because that man is always working. We gave him that whole Last Man Standing series, which I believe jumped to 10 different networks and, like, killed on all of them. So
I will say, once again, one of the only good things that Tim Allen gave us through Home Improvement was having his co-star Patricia Richardson become famous, and then giving us her son Joseph Castle Baker.
Right. It was all predestined via Tim Allen.
Yeah. Do you know that Patricia Richardson is also Betty Gilpin's godmother?
No. What?
Yes.
We know Betty Gilpin a little bit, and she's keeping her royal lineage away from us.
Yeah.
I just remember Patricia Richardson being on that weird show Strong Medicine for a while on Lifetime.
You know, I never watched Strong Medicine, but I did watch Army Wives.
I think Army Wives is a little bit after that, but yes, I mean, that is the prime generation of Lifetime. After they produced things like Intimate Portrait for years and years, and I watched every single one of those fucking episodes.
I do want to point out that when I say I watched Army Wives, I only watched the Ashanti season.
which is like the Shelley Long on Cheers, I understand, that era, yeah.
Alright, that's our show this week. So, thanks to Joel Kibbutzer for being here, and we will see you next week. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III
and Louis Fertel.
Our editor is Charlotte Landis, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer.
Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nara Malkonian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week.
In order to support our show, we need the help of some great advertisers. And we want to make sure those advertisers are ones you'll actually want to hear about. But we need to learn a little bit more about you in order to make that impossible. So go to podsurvey.com/keepit and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you better. That's podsurvey.com/KEEP-IT. That way, we can bring on advertisers that you won't want to skip. But imagine skipping listening to me and Lewis's lovely voices talk about things that we want you to buy. Once you've completed the quick survey, you can enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/KEEP-IT. And thanks again for your help.